Hello everyone, welcome to Computer Science E1. Today is all about programming, and especially in the first half of this lecture, it's going to be very interactive, so get ready to stand up, get ready with some pieces of paper. We're going to have just a little bit of fun before we really dive into some of the other stuff that we talk about, most particular Scratch, which is an application that will allow you to build programs or games in a somewhat simplistic way, but in a way that also will help you hopefully learn a lot of programming constructs and a lot of ideas behind programming a computer. So when we are talking about programming, what are we talking about? What do you think this might mean?
Source code.
Source code, okay, but can we be more general? What are we, when we say that we're going to program something, what are we referring to? Right, exactly. So we are going to tell the computer what to do. Usually we're going to make a program of some kind that will have the computer do something. For example, we might write a program that acts as a calculator. We might write a program that helps us search for names in a phone book, for example. And so in order to accomplish all of these tasks, we must write, or eventually these programs must be written in the language that computers speak, which are ones and zeros. So there are certain combinations of ones and zeros that computers understand as being instructions and execute them based on what they are told. And so before we get into a little bit more detail about that, we should talk about algorithms, or just something. An algorithm is a way of performing some task just with a fixed set of instructions. This is a little bit more general than programming a program, for example, or writing a program that does something very specific. When we talk about an algorithm, we're usually talking about a way of accomplishing some task. And so I have here very thick yellow pages for the Boston metro area. And I want to find a name in this yellow pages. How do I do that? Open the book, but to where? To the index. Well, this whole thing is essentially an index of names, so where should I open the book to? Well, let's just say that I'm just looking for a name. What are the steps that I can go through in order to look for a particular name? So what we want, the end goal here is to define an algorithm that would allow me as a computer to be able to search through all of the names in this book, if it's necessary to search through all of the names, find the name I'm looking for, and return the number. So if someone tells me the name of a person that's in this phone book, I can perform this algorithm, find this person in the phone book, and return to the person that asked me the question the phone number of this person. So just generally, without having to know the name of the person to look for, what can I do to find it?
Look for the letter in the alphabet.
Okay, so I look... So I can look for the letter in the alphabet. So I can start at the beginning, turn to the first page, and let's see, there's a lot of junk here. But so the first one is A. So if the last name of the person starts with A, then I just have to look for the second letter of the last name. Just keep going until I find the one. Okay, so Antonio, Patricia Antonio, for example, or some name that's in this phone book. But what if the last name starts with a Z? Now, being a computer, I may not understand the concept of an alphabet, and all of us, we've understood since grade school that we have 26 letters, goes from A to Z, and this phone book is arranged in that same order. So we know that B comes after A, and that, you know, L is near the middle of the alphabet. So us understanding, having an innate understanding of the alphabet, if we were to receive some name, or if we had to look up some name for somebody's last name that started with an L, we would know to turn approximately halfway into the phone book to begin our search. But a computer doesn't necessarily know this. It just knows that we have 26 letters, or it may not even know that. It just knows that we have to look for some particular name in the phone book. So, sure, we can do it this way, where we can go to the first page and then go to the second page and continue on and on until we go to Z, but that means we have to search through every single name in the phone book before we potentially find our person. So this is a very valid way of doing it, but it's a linear search. We have to do one thing at a time, and the worst case scenario is that we have to look through the entire phone book before finding the name that we want. even if this is fast, even if looking at every name is fast, you can imagine that looking through this entire thing adds up very, very quickly. So while a linear search is valid and we can do it, is there a better way to do this? Is there a faster way to do this? Yes.
Comparing?
Comparing how?
So you ask the computer to compare some, two digits to all of the first letters and all of the names.
To compare two digits to all of the first two.
So look at all of the names and look for example, if it's an H, and compare what you told it to look for to H. If it looks at A, it doesn't look like H, skip it. It doesn't look like B, skip it. Keep going.
So that's essentially the same thing. When we're talking about searching from the beginning of the phone book, we have to look at the first letter. So we have to compare the first letter of the name that we are looking for to the first letter of the name that's actually in the phone book. So there is actually a comparison that's being done, and that is the thing that could take a certain amount of time, is to do a comparison not only once, but through all several million names that exist in this phone book. So that is a very good point. It's just that that's also part of the linear search that we have to do. So doing a comparison we will most certainly have to do, but is there some way, is there some algorithm that would help us do this more quickly? Yes. So assign a value to the letters. So even if all of these people were sorted, let's say, by their social security numbers rather than through their names, we still have the problem where we would have to start at zero or whatever the first social security number is in this list and go through everyone until we find the one that matches. So even though now we could have rearranged all of the names, jumbled them up because the social security numbers obviously are not in alphabetical order based on people's names, but we could still potentially, in the worst case, have to look at every single name that exists. So is there, yes?
You can split it in half over and over again, so you can say, it's from A to L, look at this part. If it is, then it's from A to G, look at this part. If not, from G to L, look here.
Right, that's perfect. That's very good. So what we would do is basically open it right in the middle. We would just take the entire list that we have and divide it in half and take a look at that middle name, for example. So this, well, I turn to the yellow pages rather than the white pages. So if I go about halfway through the white pages, we'll see that I get to L, for example. So now if I'm looking for a last name that starts with G, I know that I can tell the computer that G is less than L, so I can disregard this half, this back half, L through Z. I do not have to search that list at all. So I have already eliminated half of all of the names in this phone book just by doing this simple comparison. So then I can divide L in half, or I can divide this list in half, and I get somewhere, let's say, to C. So I'm just doing it very crudely here. Most likely it would be D or something. And now I can say, okay, this letter G that I'm looking for is greater than C. So now I have already, of that half, eliminated another half. So now I'm down to a quarter of the list. So I can keep going in this way. And actually, this is a very, very fast way of doing it. This is basically a binary search. It's called a binary search rather than a linear search. And you reduce, every time you do a comparison, you reduce the number of names that you have to search for in half. So even if we have a list that's, let's say, 4 billion names long, which is a bit long for this phone book, but if we had a phone book for the entire world, let's say, have about 6 million names, if you divide it in two, and you divide it in two, and you divide it in two, in the worst case, you'll only need about 32 or 33 searches to look for the one name that you need in this very long list of 4 or 6 billion names. So how did I come up with this number? How does 32 come from, or where does 32 come from? Well, since we are dividing it in half, let's say that we have 4.2 billion. And I divide it in half one time, so now I get 2.1 billion. So that's one step. Divide it in half again, and I get 2.1 divided by 2, 1.05. Okay, I will round. Let's round. That sounds like a good idea. So now I have 500 million, 3. And look, now already, in just three steps, we have gotten down from our 4.2 billion names down to 500 million. And this is still a lot of zeros, but it's way more manageable. So we can keep going, 250 million, 125 million, let's see, 75 million. So hopefully if you keep doing this, you'll notice that it really does take only 32, 33 steps at the worst case to find the one name that we were looking for. So if we had done a linear search, at the worst case, we would have to search through 4.2 billion names to find this person that we wanted to find, if they were at the very end of the list. Doing it with this binary search, we now only need 33 at the most, or 32 comparisons, in order to find this one person. That's a huge jump in speed. Even if your computer that does a comparison, even if you're doing this binary search on a computer that's much, much slower than on a computer that's doing a linear search, you can see that you've increased the speed of this algorithm in a very, very great way. So just because you have to do some particular task doesn't mean that there's always one best way to do it. This is just one example of doing a linear search, which is perhaps the most obvious and certainly the easiest way of performing a search, versus this binary search, where with just a little bit additional knowledge, we can increase the speed of this algorithm without having to increase the speed of the computer and get back the name that we want much, much more quickly. Okay, so with all of this, let's see, I do have actually an algorithm that I want all of you to attempt. So everybody stand up. Up, up, up. Okay, so this algorithm, what we are going to do is try to count all of you so we can see how many of you have actually come to class this evening. So we have to follow this algorithm. So first one is that you stand up. So far, so good. So you assign yourself the number one. So just remember in your mind that you represent the value one. Okay? So now find someone else that is standing up. So you just look around. You have to perhaps meet them, greet them, say hello, shake their hand, do whatever is necessary. But you find one person that is also standing up. When you have that person, let's go to step four. Add your number to that person's number. So I'm one, John is one, so hi John. So now I'm the number two, but John is also the number two, but the trick is that one of you should now sit down. So you have to decide and fight and punch, if necessary, your way to standing up. So John, go ahead and sit down. So now, okay, when you sit, the person that is standing, please remember your number. Okay, so, all right, so we now should have approximately half of the class sitting down. It looks actually like a little bit more, so this should be interesting. Let's see. If you are still standing, now we're going to loop back to step three. So step three says find someone else that is standing up. So you have to do this whole process again. Greet them, say hello or whatever, and then you add your number to their number. So you have to communicate what the numbers are. Right now, you should all be two, but in case you guys did something fancy, then you might be some higher number. All right, so when that is done and you've added your number to that person's number, again, one of you decide and sit down. Actually, John, so we make sure we do this right. Can you count the number of people in this room, please, so that we can have, in just a little bit of time, figure out if we're doing this right? Okay. All right, so keep doing this. Loop over and over and again. After someone has sat down, find someone else, add your number to their number, have one of you sit down. At the end, we should have one person standing whose value is the grand total of everybody here. Okay, so we have six people. Should keep going. All right, two people. I think you might need to add numbers here. So what's the total? 18. John?
Yeah, that works.
That works? Okay, wait, is that right, though? Is it actually 18?
No, there are 20 people in the class.
Is that including you and me, though?
What?
Is that including you and me, or what?
Everyone is 23, not including you, me, and Chris is 20.
Okay, so this always happens. We're always one or two off, but good job. You guys got very close. Usually we have this 10% error, so that tends to happen with this sort of algorithm. But so you can imagine that there's other ways, perhaps less complicated ways, of accomplishing the same thing. Basically, what John did was just a linear count. He just went 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, so on and so forth, which is very easy for us to do, and it may be somewhat quick, but it may not necessarily be quicker for a computer, just because a computer has very rigid instructions. It takes a fixed amount of time to do a certain number of things, and so if we can have it do fewer things, then it will obviously take less time to do it. So if we were all computers, we could hope that this would be a much faster algorithm. Okay, so this algorithm that's written up here, this is the beginning of an example, something else that we're going to get into called pseudocode, where code is like this idea that was brought up earlier this morning. It's a way of programming, or it's what you type into a computer when you are programming in order to write a program or in order to get some code to run as a program on your computer. So pseudocode, then, is some mix between English and an actual computer program where it becomes very easy for us to understand because it's written in plain English, but it's structured very much like how a computer program would be structured, in that you would have if statements, for example, or so like we have a loop right here. If something is happening, then we have to go back to a certain step. And these are constructs that are all available in programming. So what I have here is something a little bit stranger than this phone book. But what all of you are going to be doing is writing pseudocode for an algorithm that helps me change this baby's diaper. So, we're not going to use a real baby for many obvious reasons, or for many reasons that will become obvious later on. But right now, your task is to take out a piece of paper and a pen and write instructions in pseudocode. So in pseudocode basically being essentially the same thing that we have up here for this algorithm. So write some pseudocode that will help me change this baby's diaper. So you'll have a couple of minutes to do that, and we will have some fun changing this baby's diaper in just a second. Okay, if you could pass your algorithms down to the end of your aisle, please, and John, if you could pick them up for me, and we will hopefully find some good stuff here. So the point of this, as a reminder, was that we need to change this baby's diaper. I guess I need to put a diaper on this baby to begin with. I sincerely hope that all of these have not been used in the many years that they have been sitting in this bag.
We just spend the rest of the class reading these out loud.
I wish. Sometimes we decide to do peanut butter and jelly, and that gets awfully messy really quickly. Okay. All right, let's see. Okay, I like this one because it's simple. And certainly the point of this is not to embarrass anyone, but just to make a point about algorithms and pseudocode. So I have here a happily sleeping baby with a diaper that needs changing quite badly. So It says remove baby's diaper. So I don't know how to do that, so I'll just try to remove it. That doesn't work. Okay, so already you can see that we have some problems with some of our pseudocode. Oh, perfect timing. Okay, so here we have one. It says, oh, I suppose I should fix the damage I did to the baby's diaper. All right, first step says, lay baby on changing table. So it's not very explicit. It's a pretty good instruction for perhaps a human to understand, but it's not very good for me as a machine. So I will put the baby on the changing table, remove dirty diaper by opening Velcro sides. So, well, those are under here. It's not the most convenient of locations for the Velcro because the baby is unfortunately upside down. Throw away dirty diaper in the trash can. Okay. Well, I mean, I guess I can try to grab the... Okay, so again, right here we've run into just a small problem in that the diaper was still on the baby's bottom at the time, so unfortunately the baby got thrown into the trash can. But let's assume for a moment that this were proceeding normally. So if I wanted to throw away the dirty diaper in the trash can, it doesn't say to wrap it up or anything, so pretend that that area there is my trash can. Let's see, apply a new diaper by lifting up the baby's legs. Well, again, I don't have a new diaper. I'd have to first go into the Huggies bag and pick one up and then open it. So there's a number of steps here that must be explicitly stated for the computer or the machine to understand. Let's see, so I will lift up, let's see, it said apply new diaper by lifting up the baby's legs. So I will lift them up, place diaper under baby, fold top front of diaper up toward baby's stomach. Well, that's going to be a tough one. Try that. And attach Velcro straps on either side of diaper. So now I have, unfortunately, wrapped the wrong end of the baby in a diaper. Okay, so again, hopefully you can see why we are not trying this on live babies.
And why you're not allowed to babysit anymore.
Okay, would you like to try one?
No, I'm good.
Okay, let's see.
Though, can I point out that about 10 minutes before class started, I got a panic text message from Dan saying, I can't find the baby.
Luckily, I found someone who knew where the baby was. oh, okay, this one looks to be a good one. So let me fix this diaper so we can reset. The very first step says to gently place baby on its back on a soft surface. So already we are doing very, very well with these steps. Okay, so I will gently place baby on its back on a soft surface. Luckily, this floor is carpeted, so that's soft to me. Let's see, remove all clothing that covers baby's diaper. Oh, that's a very good step. I didn't think of that before. Let's see. So apparently the baby is not visible on camera. Is that better? Okay. So if this baby had clothes, then we would have run into this problem before, but now we will just pretend that we removed this baby's clothes. However, notice that it doesn't say how to remove the clothing, so we could do some form of tearing or using a scissors and just cutting it all off, something that's just very drastic, but as a computer that doesn't understand the requisite steps, you can see how this could get pretty tough pretty quickly. So it says untape diaper and remove, folding quickly to suppress stink. Okay, I see. Yes. I will un-Velcro, and I suppose it doesn't really tell me how to take off the diaper, so I'll just take it off like this, but quickly I have to fold it and tape it. But unfortunately, had this diaper had stuff in it, it may have fallen all over baby. Place dirty diaper aside. Grab baby by ankles and gently lift legs to leave bum exposed, wipe clean. Okay, so I don't have anything to wipe with, so we will pretend that I performed that step. Rub skin cream. Man, somebody must have just had a baby. Rub skin cream or baby powder on baby's skin. Again, I am not doing a very good job with supplying the stuff here. Let baby's legs down. Open a new diaper. That means I have to walk all the way over here. Grab a diaper. Let's see. Open it. Move the baby a little bit over here. Is that okay? Okay, let's see. Slide rear side of diaper under baby's lower back. So, okay, I will do that. Okay, well, I'll have to cheat a little bit. Okay, there. Next step, open tape on diaper, which I have done now. Pull diaper semi-tight around baby's torso. It doesn't say which end, so I can just assume this end here. So I'll tape that to the sides. Too bad it's not sticky enough. Let's see, secure diaper with tape. And I don't have tape either, so this will have to do. So this is actually the best so far, just because I am being a little bit more lenient, but also because we actually were able to place down the baby gently and do a variety of other tasks. And so hopefully you can see the point of this by now, is that we as humans make certain assumptions when we are told some specific set of instructions. Computers do not make these assumptions. They do exactly what they are told. And if they don't know how to perform a task, they will sometimes just give you an error saying, I don't know how to do that, or usually something much more cryptic, or it will just do something completely unexpected. So be sure that you understand when you're writing these algorithms or when you are using a programming language that where you have to use or you have to implement some sort of an algorithm, that you're very specific with what you want it to do and what that computer should accomplish in this algorithm. And we do actually have one more example of pseudocode. And for this, we will need John. So John, could you please come to the front in the hot seat, so to speak? So we have here some pseudocode that will allow us to... Let me move you over a little bit.
Sir.
We have here some pseudocode that will allow us to, or allow John, rather, to find some socks in his sock drawer and put them on. And let's see, so John, you'll have to remove your shoes and socks for this.
Put on this.
And hopefully the radius is large enough that nobody will notice. Okay, so the very first step in this pseudocode says let socks on feet equal to zero. So what do you think this means? What are we doing here in this very first line of code? I heard something. Can you say it a little bit louder?
Establishing he has no socks on.
Okay, very good. So, yes, did you have something to add?
You're saying that when there's you're placing a value on when he doesn't have socks on his feet or when he does.
Right, exactly. So we are placing a value on whether or not he has socks on his feet, or at least the number of socks that he has on his feet. And more specifically, with this first line of code, we are defining a variable. And a variable is just some place, essentially, where we can store some value in it. And in it, we are just calling this variable socks on feet, so that in the future, we can reference socks on feet and determine how many or what the number of that variable is. So right now, if we were to look up socks on feet, we would find that it has zero, which implies to us as programmers, and hopefully to the computer through this algorithm or through this pseudocode, that John has no socks on his feet. Okay, next step. While socks on feet exclamation point equals sign 2. So this exclamation point equals sign may look a little bit strange if you're not familiar to it, but just realize that an exclamation point means not in computer terms. So when we say exclamation point equals, we are saying not equals 2. So we're saying while socks on feet is not equal to 2 something something. So what is the second line of code? What does this do for us? Yes.
If you were wearing socks, you would not be doing that.
That's right. So yeah, so strictly speaking, if he was wearing socks, two socks specifically, he would not be performing these next steps. So you can imagine that if he doesn't have two socks on his feet, what's going to happen? So right now, socks on feet is equal to 0. So what's going to happen? And the computer reads this. That's right. So it's going to go through this loop. So what this is, we've essentially defined a loop. So every time we complete all of these tasks here, the computer is going to go back up to the second line and do this comparison again. Is socks on feet equal to 2? If it is, then it will not perform the code in here. If it isn't, it will continue to perform the code that is in this loop. So in this way, we can continue to loop through this same code that we've written over and over and over again without having to copy-paste a lot of this code. Okay, third line is hopefully pretty self-explanatory. John opens sock drawer. So John opens his sock drawer. Then the next line, look for a sock. So he'll have to rummage around, and eventually, if you find a sock, all right, so he has found a sock. So now we have here an if statement. If something is true, then we perform some code. If you find a sock and John has found a sock, then we perform these next few lines. Put on sock.
This visual is invaluable.
I am glad that this visual helps you.
Really making this clear to me.
Okay, so he puts on the sock. So now socks on feet plus plus. This is yet another construct that's very, very common in computer science. All we are telling it to do is to increment this variable by 1. So we are saying that socks on feet is no longer 0, it is now 1. If we were to do, plus plus, whenever you see that, just realize that it means that you're incrementing something by 1. Frequently you will see it in a loop like I plus plus or a variety of other things where it's just some variable, you're incrementing that variable, value of that variable by 1. Okay, next line of code, it says, look for matching sock. So John, you gotta look for a matching sock through your sock drawer. And if you find a matching sock, which he has, then put on the matching sock. All right, so then socks on feet plus plus, so now what is the variable socks on feet equal to?
2,
right, very good. Okay, close sock drawer. All right, so you close the sock drawer. All right, so this else, notice that you can tell through the indentation what belongs where. This else statement belongs to this just previous if statement. So if he had not found a matching sock, then something else would have happened. Because he did find that matching sock, this block of code ran, or this particular section of the algorithm ran. Otherwise, if we did not find a matching sock, which luckily he did have matching socks on today, he would have to do this. So what does this mean? If he found some other sock that was not matching to the sock that he had on right then, what would be the steps? So remove the first sock from the foot, presumably put the sock back in the sock drawer, and then we do socks on feet minus minus. So can you infer what this minus minus would do instead of the plus plus? Yeah, subtract by 1. It's a decrement instead of an increment. So whatever value it was at the time, remember that this would have been back to 0 because the socks on feet plus plus up there changed the 0 to 1. Then we would have made the 1 back to a 0. However, because he did find a matching sock, we ran this code, and this code did not run. Okay, so there's a difference. We had a branch here. It had to make, the computer had to make a decision. If something was true, it would go in one direction. If something else was true, it would go in the other direction. But both code, both sections of code will not run. Okay? So now we have another else here. What does this else go to? Right, the first if, which is all the way up here on line 5, if you find a sock. So if he did not find a sock, so let's say this was summer and he was wearing flip-flops instead of, or sandals instead of shoes and socks, then he would have to perform this code, do laundry and replenish sock drawer. Pretty straightforward, right? But it's an algorithm that would allow John to put on socks, matching socks, on his feet in the morning. But are there any bugs in this algorithm? Yes?
What if he were wearing two socks on each foot? It's a cold day. Maybe he wants to be wearing two pairs of socks.
What if he wants to wear two socks on each foot? So four socks total? Well, that's sort of a special case. We presumably could modify the code slightly to allow that. The first step might be to change while socks on feet does not equal to four, for example. Then we might have to perform some other changes as well in order to get that to happen. Yes?
If you have clean socks but not a matching pair?
Yes, so if you have clean socks and not a matching pair, what's going to happen? What's that? Right, he'll never have socks on. Well, more specifically, we would get into this sort of infinite loop because it would not find a matching sock. So it would remove the sock from foot, socks on feet, minus, minus, and it would go to the very top. It would just pick another random sock, put it on, try to find a matching sock, and so on and so forth. So he would just go into this infinite loop of putting on one sock, not finding a matching sock, taking off the sock, putting it back in the drawer, and then repeat, 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 repeat. So that's a potential bug in this system. Anything else? Yes?
He could have both socks on one foot.
Right. He could have both socks on one foot because we don't specify which foot to put each sock on. So he could have put one sock, the first sock on his right foot, then the second sock on his right foot as well. So that is certainly a potentially big bug that we could have as well. Yes? Let's see.
And then looking for a matching sock after?
Let's see. So, you mean, are you talking about this, if you find a matching sock?
No, the two lines before it, socks on feet, and then the plus plus. That means put on sock, right, and then put another sock on it? Doesn't that mean that? And then the following line would say he's looking for a matching sock after putting on the second sock?
No, it should not, because if we have found, so we start out with zero socks on the feet, then we basically put on a sock that we have found in the drawer. Then we increment so that we have one sock. So we have socks on feet equal to one now, which is true. He has one sock on. If he finds a matching sock, then he puts on the other one. Otherwise, he removes the first sock from the feet and decrements it again. So even if he doesn't find a matching sock, he will remove the first one. And there's not this potential to have additional socks on his feet that way, because we are taking care of it. If no matching sock was found, then we remove the socks on his feet. Okay, John, thank you very much.
Thank you.
That was very enlightening, the opening the drawer and all of these things. All right. Okay, so that's pseudocode. Any questions on pseudocode? So we went over just a few of these constructs already. We've talked about what a variable is. It's just some place in memory that you can think of as storing some value. And in this case, we had a variable called socks on feet, where we used it to store a number that defines how many socks we had on feet. We had a couple of if statements. If something happens, we branch off in this one direction and run the code. Otherwise, we branch off in a different direction and run some other code, and also a loop. While something is not true, we will perform some segments of code. So this is a pretty good example of pseudocode in that it mixes plain English with some of these programming constructs. So not only are we using plus plus as the incrementer and minus minus as the decrement, but we are also indenting some of this code so that it becomes easy to determine what blocks of code are subblocks, or you know, they're basically portions of code that belong to some parental hierarchy. So you can see that while, in that while statement at the very top, all of this code that is indented belongs to that while loop. So everything that is highlighted here is indented at least once, which means that it belongs to that while loop. So while this while loop is doing its thing, all of this code will be run. Similarly, with the if statements, we can determine what code belongs to which if statement because of the way that we have indented it. So this is very, very similar, if not exactly the same, as this pretty printing that you have been employing in your XHTML. We can figure out what blocks of code belong to which hierarchical structures. Okay. Anything you want to add to this?
No, not yet. Just let me know when it's time.
Well, why don't you have a go?
All right. So let's put this into context. So this is pseudocode, as Dana said, which is English-like syntax. But what people actually program in is not quite something like this, but something that's a little more precise. So the question that came up earlier about, well, what if the person wants to put on four socks, two on a foot? Like, there's clearly some ambiguities in this code, but that's because we wrote it really for the sake of discussion. But when it comes time to program a computer, you need to be much more precise. And you need to tell a computer exactly, as Dan said, what you want it to do. Because, like the baby example demonstrated, it can't just assume, it can't infer. So you can only typically do some number of well-defined tasks. So whereas here, we're relying sort of on some general understanding of what it means to put on a sock. Well, a computer's not going to even know what that means until you program it to even know what it means to put on a sock. So there's a whole bunch of programming languages in this world. What are some of the languages with which you might already be familiar? C++ is one. What are other languages you've heard of or know, friends of yours know?
Java.
Java is another popular one.
Perl.
Python.
Ruby.
If you know none of these things, that is A-OK, but there's a whole bunch of popular programming languages and even a whole bunch more relatively unpopular languages. Some of the most common languages today remain C++ or C#. In fact, if you are running some Microsoft product on your desktop or some Windows software in general, odds are it was written in a language called C++ or C#. If you are visiting a website that is dynamic, that is, its output changes based on who is logged in or based on the time of day, like many, many websites today, whether it's Facebook or CNN, anything that's at all interactive, you're probably visiting a website that underneath the hood, yes, is using HTML or XHTML for the aesthetics of the site, but the programming code that's actually generating different XHTML based on the page that you're visiting, based on the value of your stock portfolio, based on your Facebook profile, is probably something like Perl or P-E-R-L or PHP, an acronym, or a whole bunch of other web-oriented languages. Well, we in this course can certainly do no justice in just one lecture on the art or the skill of programming. But it is certainly our goal in this course to give you a taste of programming so that you can exit the course with at least a sense of what your software developer friends or associates are doing so that you have a sense, perhaps, of where you can go after a course like this and actually dabble in programming yourselves. And by far the most effective environment that I've found personally for introducing programming in this fashion is this environment called Scratch. So a couple of years ago, some researchers at MIT's Media Lab, with which you might be familiar, developed a programming environment, a programming language called Scratch. And it was meant early on to really be for children in after school programs whereby students would gather, and with the relatively limited computing resources that some after-school programs have, they would be able to run a program like this by double-clicking an icon on the desktop and then program. And so let's put this into context. So this is Scratch, and this is literally Scratch, the cat known as Scratch, and think of this as his little world. So this rectangle at top right is the stage on which this sprite, so to speak, this character can move. As we'll see, we'll be able to move him up, down, left, right, and do a whole bunch of other things. On the left-hand side here is a palette of sorts of scripts, and they look like puzzle pieces, because what the folks at MIT decided to do was to use this puzzle piece metaphor for the idea of programming. So as Dan did with that pseudocode, even though he typed it at the keyboard, he pretty much was connecting different pieces of logic together, an if condition here, a loop here, a variable here. So even though he was typing it, he was nonetheless kind of fitting all of these nice logical components together. And that's precisely the visual that Scratch is meant to give you. Specifically, if I want to write a program in this environment or language called Scratch, I'm going to first go to one of the control blocks, so to speak. And just to zoom in for a moment, you'll see that these puzzle pieces each have different shapes, and notice that they all have these stubby little things, the idea of which is that you can lock them together, so much like a puzzle. So I'm going to go ahead and click the top one here, the one labeled when green flag is clicked, because that is the primary block via which I'm going to kickstart the process of moving that little guy around. Now I want to do something very, very simple. So I'm going to go and change the category of puzzle pieces that I'm looking at. I'm going to go to the looks category. And again, you don't need to tonight sort of take all of this in. We're just going to pick and choose some of the most interesting blocks. And I see the screen is unfortunately a bit blurry today, but there's one up there that says, say hello. So I'm going to click and drag. And notice as soon as I get close to this orange block, notice that a little white line appears. And that's saying, hey, this will interlock here if you let go. So if I do go ahead and let go, notice the two pieces have snapped together. Now, hello is a little boring. I'm going to be a little more personal and say, hey, computer science E1, exclamation point. And now, as you might have noticed, there's a real green flag at top right. If I go ahead and click this, notice that my program is going to run. So that green flag is sort of the Scratch equivalent of double-clicking an icon on your desktop. So certainly underwhelming right now, but let's do a little something more interesting. Dan already talked about loops, for instance, as well as conditions. So you know what? Let me go back to my control category. And notice that there is this thing here, a forever loop. So I'm going to click and remove this bluish puzzle piece. I'm going to instead snap in this forever piece so that now the idea that we're saying is when the green flag is clicked, do the following forever. All right, well, what do you want me to do forever? Just imagine that this is, again, is a stage. The cat can do a whole bunch of things. What do you want me to try to create here on the fly? Keep your expectations low. This is not canned demo. Dance. Okay, I'm going to interpret dance as at least move. We'll start with move, how about? And let's see, it looks like there's a motion category here. All right, so let's see, move some number of steps. So notice if I go inside this forever loop, notice there doesn't seem to be room, but the program is dynamic. So if I let go, it's going to grow to fill. So it's the shapes of these pieces that matter, not necessarily the size. I'm going to do this a little slowly. I'm going to say move one step. And, you know, that's enough for now. I'm going to get rid of the say block just by dragging it to the left. And I'm going to hit play again. And, okay. So now we got a little something going on there. It's not amazing. And, in fact, that's kind of a problem. He keeps going. So maybe we can actually sense that we're at the side of the wall, right? In other words, Dan introduced that idea of a condition. Well, it seems intuitive that maybe there's a condition that says, if you hit the right-hand wall, maybe we should flip it around 180 degrees and go back. So let's see what we've got. All right, so there's a sensing category. Let's see, mouse down, touching. Okay, touching is interesting. What's under here? Oh, this is interesting. So if touching, so I'm going to click and drag this in here. I'm not quite sure where I want to put it yet, but I'm going to go back to the control category. And let's see, scroll down. Which of these strikes you as a condition, a branch? Yeah, so I see a couple people mouthing it, and now someone's admitted to it. So what about this? So if, let me slide this in here. So let me move, but let me also check after taking every step, if I'm touching the edge, let's do something. So if touching, now notice this is a little bit of a diamond-like shape, and if I hover over this other diamond-like shape, it too will sort of grow to fill that. So I'm sort of completing the phrase, if such and such. Now what do we want to do here? So if touching, this is a little drop down. So if touching edge, all right, so that's a little interesting. What do I want to do? Well, I probably want to do something motion-wise. Well, ah, interesting. So what piece would you recommend we use here? If you can see, let me zoom in. So here are some of the move-related options. What do you propose my using? The second turn, so the second guy there. All right, so turn some number of degrees. How many degrees? Ooh, problem. Let me actually click. You can click and drag him manually temporarily. Let's see what's about to happen. Ooh, that's nice. Oops. Okay. So he seemed to actually turn roughly 90 degrees. Why might that be? Even though I only said turn 15 degrees. Can you infer from logically what might be going on here? Yeah, so it's hitting the corner, right? So it, apparently he's hitting the corner, and yeah, he's turning 15 degrees, but when he turns 15 degrees, what's he hitting? The corner. So he turns another 15, and 15, 15, 15. Eventually you get to 90, at which point he's no longer touching the edge. And so we have a guy that I'm going to claim is dancing now. And we'll sort of pause there. But if I can now fast forward to a program that's quite more remarkable than this that I've whipped up on the fly, let me show you one of my favorite that a former teaching fellow actually put together. And then after our break, we'll walk through and sort of progressively make things that are, in fact, more interesting, more compelling, because you'll see quickly that it's all not all that hard, certainly once you have a sense of the layout.
If I can interject before you show this amazing program, is that you can see that even in even in Scratch, which is really quite simplistic, it really takes things very, very literally. So even though we had intended to only rotate it by 15 degrees, just to reiterate what David said, by rotating at 15 degrees, we are still touching the edge and we must continue on. So is there some way that we could implement this idea of dancing if it doesn't have dancing? I suppose it really depends on how you are going to define it, and that's really the point. You must define for yourself what dancing is and how to do it, because just like David showed, he thinks dancing is going up and down along the right side of the edge, but that may not be what you consider it to be. So you would have to define in your own way how all of these things work.
What a perfect segue to a demo that does actually involve dancing. So I give you Raining Men. You'll find, though, that it's actually not all that more sophisticated than mine. They've just added music, which makes it feel more like dancing.
Hi, we're your weather girl. Uh-huh. And have we got news for you.
You better listen.
Get ready, all your lonely girls, and leave those umbrellas at home.
All right.
It's rising. Mm.
Rising.
I'm just getting low.
Take our 5-minute break.
Hi, everyone. So welcome back. Just a quick note, if you don't know already, prepare to shake in your shoes. We have the second of our two exams a week from today. So just be prepped for that. And it will cover lectures 6 through this week, I believe. And we will hopefully see you then. Good luck.
And then looking ahead a few weeks, recall that our last lecture is in January, but 1 week prior, we will have the second of two movie nights in which we will demo a movie called Startup.com, which is actually a wonderful look at the rise and the subsequent fall of an actual startup called GovWorks.com. As I think we said in one of the first weeks of the course, this was a company founded by a couple of fellows who at the time, really at the height of the dot-com era in the late 90s, thought it would be a wonderful idea to, with a camcorder, film everything that happened in this startup so that they could look back years later while basking in their success at how it all began. But fortunately, they kept rolling even as things kind of took this downturn. And it's wonderfully representative of a lot of the hype of the era and really the startup life in general. So popcorn from Johnny's and Kendall to come in January as well as that film. So let's try to tease apart some of the building blocks that go into writing a program like Raining Men and a whole bunch of other demos that we've come prepared with here. The goal here is not so much to teach Scratch, per se. Much like in a lot of programming courses, the goal isn't to teach you so much about the language, be it Java or C++, but about some of the basic ideas, the fundamental ideas, because much like one can go from one romance language to another, from picking up a little English, French, Spanish, Italian, because there are similarities. Similarly, in the programming world, are there similarities? And so I dare say it's even easier in the world of programming languages to teach yourself new languages, because once you understand some of the basic building blocks, loops, conditions, statements, variables, you find those same ideas across the board in most programming languages. And so really all you have to do is acclimate to a different syntax. So even though we've chosen for this course to introduce Scratch, and though it does appear at first glance to be a fairly playful, simple environment, it really has almost all of the most fundamental building blocks of any programming language. And it allows us to let you begin programming for this next problem set without, frankly, the distraction and the minutiae of typing commands at a command line and interacting with little more than a blinking prompt. So we think you'll have a good deal of fun with this. Even I, when I was first introduced to this as a grad student in a class I was taking at MIT, I think I proceeded to spend the next like 8 hours on a Friday night perfecting my own particular Sesame Street-like program. So with that said, let's slap some jargon on this just so that we can all speak the same language, and we'll see that it mirrors some of the discussions we've had through Dan's examples already. So this is the simplest of programs, perhaps, something that simply says hello or hi to the world. But let's qualify these. So statements. Statements, whether it's in Scratch or in other languages, are simply lines of code that do something specific. In this case, here are three examples. In the world of Scratch, you can say something, you can wait some amount of time, you can play some sound. And by way of the demos we've shown already, have you seen manifestations of these statements? Now, a program written with one statement after the other, probably not terribly interesting. It's the dynamism that we get from conditions and branches and variables that really allows us to start building far more interactive and more interesting programs. So here are two examples that are more interesting perhaps than my very first, in which this cat just said, hello, computer science E1. On the left-hand side here, can you describe for me what that program does, just in an English sentence or so? What's that program on the left-hand side do? Let me go ahead and zoom in if that helps. What's that do? Yeah, so it says, oh, hi, world, for 1 second. Then apparently it sort of pauses. Maybe it stops saying that. Then it says it for another second, pauses, then says it again three times. What about the one on the right-hand side here? What does this program appear to do? Yeah, so same idea. Don't say it visually, but instead play some actual sound. So this file I'll open up. So this is a program called hi3.sb. Let me go ahead and open this. And you'll notice before I click this green flag, if for sort of presentation's sake you click this little easel presentation mode icon, it simply full screens it, as most programs can do. I'm going to go ahead and hit play here. And there we have those three meows. All right, so let's build up from that to something yet more complicated. So Boolean expressions. So this is a more sophisticated label for one of the ideas that you saw both in the baby example as well as in the as well as in the sock example. So in a Boolean expression in this case is simply something that is either true or it is false. So what might that be in the context of Scratch? Well, is the sprite, the mouse, the cat rather, touching the mouse pointer? The answer to that question is either yes or no. By pointer, we mean the cursor, the arrow. So that is true or false, yes or no. And actually, if you think back to our hardware lectures, here's a recurrence of an idea. We talked in our hardware lecture about binary and things being zeros or ones, light bulbs being off or on. It's the same idea here. A Boolean expression named after a guy named Mr. Boole simply is about something that's true or false. One or zero, on or off. So what's another example? Mouse down. Well, the mouse button is either down or it is not, true or false. What about this third one in green? What does that appear to be hinting at? What kind of operation? So blank statements, but this one's actually mathematical. What does that appear to be asking? Yeah, greater than. So is something on the right greater than something on the left? That too is a Boolean expression. It's mathematically oriented, but it's still true or false. This is either greater than or it's not greater than the thing on the left. Now this bottom one is a conjunction of two Boolean expressions, because you can certainly ask yourself, is this true and is this true? And only if they're both true might you want to do something. And so by saying this Boolean expression and this Boolean expression, can you build up, as is the trend here, up to more complicated Boolean expressions? Now, why are these useful? Well, the Boolean expressions are useful because you can embed them into conditions. And that's exactly what Dan was doing in those past couple of examples. Either he was doing this to the left or this to the right, based on whether or not something was true. In the case of the sock example with John, either John had two socks on or he did not. Bang, exclamation point, equal sign. He did not have two socks on. That variable did not equal two. So notice here that in Scratch, we have that if block that you saw earlier. There's also this if-else block that allows you to go left or go right, so to speak. And then you can actually nest these things, so to speak. You can embed them, so that you can have three forks in the road or four forks in the road and do any number of different things. And similarly, can you do this in more common languages like C++ and Java? Well, let's actually use this. This example now on the left makes use of not only a statement, play sound, but it also makes use of a branch, aka condition, and also this Boolean expression, this mathematical one. So what does this program on the left do? If you're thinking, wow, this is dumb, just say what it does. Yeah, so if 2 is greater than 1, play meow. So this is sort of a very, wow, you really mean to implement it this way, right? Because 2 is always greater than 1, you would think. And so it's sort of useless having that condition. But what this hints at is this capability of doing something conditionally, doing something optionally. So let's actually fast forward to the right-hand side and see why that basic construct is useful. What does this example on the right-hand side do now? Again, you've never seen these Scratch blocks before, but again, it's really not all that hard to infer from context. So what does this do? Yeah, perfect. So take a number from 1 to 10, pick a random number apparently from 1 to 10, and if that number is less than 6, go ahead and play the sound meow. So in other words, with 50% probability, do the following. Flip a coin, so to speak, and do the following only if it comes up heads. Well, this is high5.sb. Let me go ahead and load this up. And if I go ahead and click play, let's see what happens the first time. Nothing. So what does that probably signify? Yeah, so it was a 6, 7, 8, 9, or 10 that came back. Let's try once more. So bad luck. And that happens, right? Two heads in a row when you flip a coin. Let's try a third time. There we go. Okay. Let's try again. Nothing. 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 This is a really bad streak of luck. This is probabilistically unlikely. Wow. Okay. So in some languages, the random number generator, so to speak, is not quite fair. The coin, as you will, is not quite a fair coin. But If we did that a million times, roughly 500,000 of them would, in fact, meow. So let's build up from there. So loops. So Scratch supports this idea of doing something multiple times, just like Dan's example with the socks. He did the following while John did not have two socks on his feet. The left-hand one induces intentionally, it would seem, an infinite loop, which in Dan's context of the socks was bad because it represented a bug. But an infinite loop is not necessarily a bad thing. Can you think of some program you run on a day-to-day basis that probably has this idea of an infinite loop built into it, but a loop that's nonetheless useful, even though it just runs and runs and runs? Yeah, so if you have your email configured to check every 5 minutes, every 10 minutes, or even more frequently, that's essentially an infinite loop because you want it to check again and again. Now, granted, you can forcibly quit the program by clicking the X or going to the file menu and choosing quit, but for the most part, while the program's running, the infinite loop, however implemented, is actually a useful thing. So don't necessarily equate some of these ideas like infinite loops with mistakes, but it's rather entirely context sensitive. So this one on the right, as you can infer, perhaps simply repeats the following something or other 10 times specifically. So let's do something that builds on this. So on the left-hand side, what's this program do? Pretty easy to parse. What do you got? Right, meow every 2 seconds. Now compare this in your mind to that very first example where I took the very lazy approach of saying meow, then wait 2 seconds, then meow, then wait 2 seconds, then meow, then wait 2 seconds, and then that was it, because I kind of got bored of just copying and pasting and copying and pasting. And therein lies the value, at least one value, of loops. You can tell your computer to do things again and again and again, and you yourself don't have to say again and again and again. Therein lies the power. This thing will loop forever, and that might actually be a useful thing. Annoying, to be sure, to have this thing meowing every 2 seconds, but useful. What about this one on the right? If I scroll over, it's getting a little more interesting now, which is good. What's this second example do, does it seem? Yeah, exactly. You can kind of read these things top to bottom, left to right. So if you are touching the mouse pointer, so if the sprite that's running this program is touching the mouse pointer, play sound meow, and then wait 2 seconds. And then do what? Well, do this again and again. Just keep going again and again through this loop and see what happens. So this was my implementation of what idea, would you say? How would you describe this program now in sort of real world terms? So here's the cat kind of minding its own business. Now I move my mouse, my cursor over it. This was my version of petting the cats, right? Simple idea, but relatively simple too to implement. Well, we can kind of run with this idea, get a little clever. How about this one? I seem to have an if-else. So now the cat is just meowing ad nauseum, but if you touch this cat, very bad. So there we have the idea of a branch, a condition. So if touching mouse pointer, play the sound lion. Otherwise, play meow. Wait 2 seconds. Do it again. Play, wait 2 seconds. And so forth. So again, we have what? 5, 6, 7 lines of code here, so to speak, programming code. It very quickly builds up into something more interesting. Now let's introduce variables. So you saw variables in the context of John's feet. How many socks did he have on his feet? Well, what about this? So I appear to have on the left, in orange, a variable that I sort of very reasonably called counter because I wanted to keep track of some value. So set counter to 0. This is an initialization of a variable. And again, to be clear, this is the same jargon I would use if introducing programming in Java, C++, any of these languages to students in other courses. So set counter to 0 and then forever do the following. So say counter for 2 seconds. So I'm guessing we're going to get a little cartoon bubble that says whatever the value of this variable is at this moment in time for 2 seconds, then it's going to go away for 1 second, and then what's going to happen? Yeah, so plus plus in Dan speak. So it's going to get incremented by 1, and then the whole process is going to repeat. So what I appear to have implemented here is, much like you would teach, frankly, a school child very early on, is the ability I chose for not to count sheep, but to have sheep count. So that was the witticism here. So we have a counting sheep here, and this too will just go on and on forever. But I decided that was kind of an interesting idea. What else can I do with this basic idea of a variable? What about this one on the what about this one on the right hand side? What's this thing do? Yeah. So we've seen this use of random numbers before, but that time I kind of generated a random number, then immediately used it. This time, though, it appears that I can sort of keep answers around by defining a variable called number, but then setting it to a random number. Now I can kind of reuse that number again and again, the same number, without having to regenerate one on every line of code. So this is kind of a diagnostic version of that first program. That first program being when the cat only meowed with 50% probability. Like, even I was kind of scratching my head there mentally because it wasn't meowing. It might have been nice then to see, well, let's do a sanity check. What number did the cat just come up with randomly? What number did he come up with now? Hopefully, it was some number like whatever it was, 1 to 6 to 10, right? Just to do that sanity check, and that's all I've done here. So not only is this thing going to play the sheep sounds, apparently, but it's also going to tell me what the number was just so I can get a sense of what's going on underneath the hood. So let's go ahead and play this one. Okay, he said 8, so 8 is not less than... rather, 8 is not less than 6, and so what happened? Well, nothing. We did not play the sound. All right, so let's try this again. Play. There we go. And in fact, this is actually a good point to point out to some of the fun aesthetic or audio features here. So you'll notice that in this middle pane here are what are called scripts. So this is actually, too, a reflection of the real world. Programs can be called scripts in a lot of languages. So these are my scripts. These are my building blocks here. But notice there's a couple of tabs. So the means by which I changed my cat into a sheep is I simply overlaid a GIF or JPEG or something like that on top of him. And what Scratch comes with is a whole bunch of prefabbed images. If I click the import button and I actually wanted to change my sheep, for instance, let's say to be, let's go ahead and import another animal, perhaps. We have this whole arsenal here, and you can download most anything you want. Pick an animal as you see it that you like. Spider. Ant. Okay, here we go. Insect 1A is apparently ant, very aptly named. So let's go ahead and pick that. Now, unfortunately, you've picked an animal whose sound I am not familiar with. But that's okay, because notice I'm going to go back to scripts. And now notice that my sprite has changed. Now I'm going to go to sounds, rather. I'm going to click. I only have two options right now. I can either make the ant or not on a good path here. How about vocals? We'll make this a talking ant. Let's see what we got in here. Let's try this one.
Can I come and play?
Okay, random, but.
God inspiration.
That doesn't seem to fit.
Hey.
Join us.
Well, that's not bad. All right, so let's go with this. Now go back to my scripts to see what's going on. Hit play here. Oh, but yeah, so I didn't modify it. So I imported the sound, so now it's kind of there in memory waiting for me. But as you noted, I actually need to change the programming code here so that from this dropdown, I specify which one I want it to play. So let's go ahead and do this. 6, that's not great. Less than 6? Not less than 6. Not less than 6.
Join us.
All right, so now we actually have some randomness working as we'd hoped. So what more can we do? Well, there's also this idea of an array. So thus far, we've only seen variables as the mechanism by which we can keep information around. But imagine, say, a very typical game. So a very typical game on Nintendo or computers is one of those games where you kind of go around collecting things. You have to go find the sword, or you need to go collect more magic potion, or anything along these lines, where you need to collect things. You need to support an inventory. Well, you could implement that idea with a whole bunch of variables, right? You could have a variable for your magic potion. You could have a variable for your sword, a variable for your shield. But if
if you've played any of these games or sort of watched over the shoulder of someone playing these games, there's a heck of a lot of things that are involved in these games. And so you can very quickly perhaps imagine your screen as the programmer just getting littered with dozens or even hundreds perhaps of variables. So variables themselves don't necessarily scale very well, because who wants to keep track of, you know, 100 different variables, each of which serves a different role? And so to mitigate that concern, the world introduced a long time ago this notion of an array or a vector, which is another type of data structure, a container for information, but that's a bit more dynamic. Inside of an array, can you store multiple pieces of information? So you can put into an array, so to speak, your shield and your sword and your magical potion. And let's call this array something more familiar, your inventory. So long story short, an array is just a more sophisticated data structure, kind of like a shopping bag almost, that you can put many, many different things in and then iterate over them. So you can start with the first item and take a look at it. The next one, because typically with an array, you assign every item inside of it a somewhat arbitrary number. The first one is 0, because people with computers start counting at 0, then 1, then 2, then 3. And so you don't necessarily have names for all of these variables, but you at least assign them numbers. And you can therefore go back and forth over this whole bucket of options and look for the particular item that you're interested in.
If I can interject, the example from earlier when we were talking about the algorithm used to implement searching through a phone book, we could actually use an array, a very, very large array, to store every phone number that we want. And just as David said, when we did our linear search, we could iterate through every object or every phone number that exists in this array, also known as the phone book, until we found the phone number that we were looking for.
All right, so let's see if I can't sort of paint this picture with an actual example. If I go to Fruitcraft RPG, which was created by another student. This is a game that implements precisely this idea. So I'm going to hit play. Apparently, my character is just waking up. He's hungry. It's time to go find some fruit. So the object of this game now is to interact with the program. So thus far, we've pretty much seen animations and stories being played out, but you can also use various building blocks in Scratch that allow you to respond to any character of the keyboard. So in this case, there's probably an if condition that says, if the up arrow is pressed, do what? Yeah, move north some number of steps. Else if down arrow is pressed, move south some number of steps. So again, same ideas, more sophisticated interaction. Now, it actually took me, first time I was playing with this student's work, a while to figure out that this is actually a painting of a piece of fruit, not actually a piece of fruit. Never mind the bug or reality that you can apparently walk on walls in this particular universe, but I eventually figured out that this arrow was telling me to go this way. So I went down here, and so now you can actually in Scratch change the whole stage, so to speak. So this is just another big GIF or big JPEG, something that they whipped up either within Scratch or imported from the web or Photoshop or something like that. And here was a whole bunch of stuff. So I'm about to step on this, what appears to be an orange, and click over it. And indeed, at top left is a depiction of my array, of my inventory. Now, hopefully, cherries are going to show up there. Yep. And notice that these two are numbered. They chose, because this was not meant for computer scientists, but rather normal people, they start numbering at 1, 2, 3, like a normal person would, rather than 0. This is kind of interesting. So what construct, what programmatic construct is probably implementing this idea? Yeah, so if over sign, if touching sign, say the following. Else, if not, don't say anything at all. Now let me go get some pineapple. Okay, got that. But some bananas, some apples, and then the fruit place is perhaps where I want to go. So here's a guy apparently at a counter. And apparently this is sort of the boss. This is the end game, I think. So here's my fruit platter. And that's what I want, right? So you can build up. So we have a few different screens here, but I'm finally doing some more interesting things. Well, what else can we do? More interaction. So this is a more sophisticated topic, actually, than would typically be introduced in even an introductory programming course, but it's very familiar, certainly to all of you, perhaps not with this word, but it's also very accessible within Scratch. So recall, perhaps from our discussion of hardware and software, that computers can kind of, sort of, do multiple things at once. You can have Word running, AOL Instant Messenger. You can have Excel, and a whole bunch of other programs all running at the same time. But recall that they're not actually all running at the same time. You only have one CPU, or maybe two cores these days, but you only are seeing the illusion of multiple things happening at once. Computers are so damn fast, billions of cycles per second these days, gigahertz, that they can essentially execute a little bit of Microsoft Word for a few microseconds or a few milliseconds to create the illusion of working on Word. Then it can very quickly context switch, change to another program altogether, do a little quick work here, grab your email really fast, then change to your instant messaging program, pop up that window to show you the instant messenger, go back to Word, finish printing that document. In other words, you get this appearance of parallelism, even though the computer's really only doing one thing at a time. Now, the reason that you can do multiple things at once on a computer is that computers and even individual programs are what are called multi-threaded. So just as the idea of a thread kind of implies some very small thing that exists in lockstep with other threads typically, the idea of a thread in programming is that every thread, every mini program in a computer can be doing something different. So a program or a computer that is multi-threaded can, in short, do multiple things at once. That's all. So Scratch supports this idea of threads, whereby you can write one script and have your sprite doing something, but you can write another script that still belongs to that same sprite so that the sprite can essentially be doing something else at once. Now imagine the idea of a human. You know, even in the real world, when you are crossing the street, you're probably doing a few things at once. You are moving your feet, so that's kind of one program you're executing. Move, 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 and so forth. But if you're sort of practicing what mom taught you, you're probably looking this way and looking this way. So you're multitasking. You are multi-threaded effectively as a human because you're able to do different statements, move and look at once. And Scratch allows you to do this as well. So consider this example. So this example here just has me moving as we did in some of the earliest examples. So I chose to use the scream sound here. This too. All of my programs get very annoying very quickly. But let's take a look at the second version of this, because that was single-threaded. There's only one script. But now if I want two sprites interacting, take a look at this one. So I'm going to go ahead and hit play. Notice that this bird is one sprite. He's doing something, bouncing off the edge, similar in spirit to our little thing before. The cat, though, is kind of moving somewhat independently of the bird. So what's going on? Well, notice that down at bottom right, you can now see your multiple sprites. And each sprite gets its own script area. So you can assign different scripts, that is threads, to different sprites. And so right now I'm looking at the cat script. Let's for a moment just look at the bird script, because that was sort of the one we focused on first as he moved around. His script's pretty short. So let me zoom in here. And you'll see that when the green flag is clicked, what does the bird do? Apparently, he goes to some hard-coded location. So that little stage, as I called it, the big white rectangle, you can think of, I think, as the middle being 0, 0, and then negative numbers are to the left, positive numbers are to the right. I think it's that. Or 0, 0 is the top left-hand corner. I'd have to figure it out again. But I figured out when writing this program, that's where I want the bird to start, negative 150, comma 150. I want him to point in a 45-degree angle, so he kind of goes diagonally across the screen, and then do the following, forever if not touching cat. So this is kind of a merger of the idea of a loop and a condition simultaneously. So Scratch kind of melded the two ideas into one block. Move three steps. If on the edge, bounce. So with very few building blocks, do I have the bird just kind of doing its own thing, going this way, bounce off the edge at another, like a 90-degree angle. If you hit another edge, bounce, bounce, bounce. But the bird just kind of ignores the cat entirely. But the cat, meanwhile, who's executing simultaneously, thanks to threading, appears to have the birds in his sights. So the bird starts, or rather the cat starts at a nearby but not identical location. He then points in a random location, because I wanted this program to be a little interesting so that it can kind of play out differently each time. And then he forever does the following. Well, one, if he's immediately touching the bird, well, play the lion sound and then stop the script. Game over. He caught the bird. Else, go ahead. And notice I'm saying else, but there is no else, but it's kind of implied in this case because it's going to happen anyway. Else, point towards the bird. and move one step. So I actually have the bird, I think, moving a little more quickly. The cat is still moving after him a little more slowly, but he's kind of, again, only pointing in the direction that the bird is in. So very gradually does he actually get closer and closer and closer to the bird, because the bird, as you've seen, is just completely oblivious to the existence of this second thread, this second sprite. And so ultimately, because this is in a forever loop, the bird, the cat, is effectively stalking the bird, and so we get exactly this. So if you pay closer attention this time, notice the cat is going exactly where the bird is, more slowly, but because the bird is oblivious, the cat eventually catches him. So how can we build up? Well, how about for this next one, a volunteer who would bravely come on up here? So simple, but so much fun, I promise. Don't make me pick John by default. Who would dare come up? Look at this. Wow, look at this fun. Any volunteer? Save me from the awkwardness. Everyone's looking at John. John, would you like to come down? Wow, 0 points for participation from everyone else today. So here are the directions. This was by a former student named Carlos. You're just going to use the mouse here, and Carlos's preferred means of interaction is just click the player when you want him to run and kick the ball rightward, and the goal is to get the ball to hit this little red and black target. All right, so here we go. And just click this guy as many times as you'd like. Count. Oh, there we go. All right, a big hand for John. This was awkward, I'm sure. And it only gets more awkward as you miss more and more, I'm sure. So that was, actually, let me pull that up quickly. We won't look through all of its scripts, but what you'll find is that, one, Scratch comes with a whole bunch of projects, and some of those are very instructive because you can sort of learn what the program's doing just by reading through its scripts. In this case, this student implemented, ultimately, 5 different sprites, each of which is apparently doing something independently, right? The goal is moving back and forth, and we've already seen pretty much how to do that. It looks like a goal this time, but we did it with the cat in the beginning. We've done it in a bird. It's just going up and down and bouncing off the edge. So appreciate that when it comes time to implement your next problem set, if you kind of have a vision in mind, like I want to implement a soccer game, don't try to implement a soccer game. Rather, take baby steps, so to speak. Take bites out of the program, whereby think about what you want to implement and realize, all right, there's got to be a moving goal. That's my goal, kind of pun intended. So let me go ahead and define a sprite. Let me do some little Photoshop work or use Scratch's built-in graphical editor, make that thing, and then let me just get that right. So it doesn't do anything yet. It's not all that fun to play, but at least I've implemented the first part of it. Once I've got the goal going back and forth, let me go ahead and maybe put the stage on there, the green field. Once I've got that aesthetic detail out of the way, let me implement the player. Now the player has to respond to a mouse click. I don't want him to go all the way across the screen, so I need some kind of script that says maybe if mouse down and touching player, what do I want to do? Well, move some number of steps, 90 degrees or eastward, but then stop at a certain point. So maybe it's a loop that only executes so many times. You can implement these things in many different ways. And now you still can't play the game because according to my voiceover here, the player is now just going to run to midfield and then do nothing. So now we need to introduce another sprite, the one that looks like a ball. And maybe you can just leave it as a cat initially, right? Have him kick the cat again and again. You come back to that aesthetic. But once he makes contact with the ball, maybe you have a building block that says, if soccer player touching soccer ball, what do you want to do? Well, then the soccer ball should actually move across the screen. And the player, meanwhile, should go back. So keep that in mind, certainly, as you tackle your own Scratch projects, that you shouldn't and don't want to probably bite it all at once. Even professional programmers don't sit down and say, you know, today I'm going to implement Microsoft Word. No, you start much more reasonably. You write a program that opens an empty window first. Then you add the ability to choose from a file menu. Then you add the new option and the open option. And again, you build incrementally. And you'll find, too, by taking these baby steps, so to speak, that you will find it much easier to chase down problems or bugs because you'll have only bitten off so much in the past, say, half hour or hour. Well, this implementation was from another student. It's similarly interactive and a bit more modern, perhaps. She did not sit there late night, apparently in her dorm room, yelling into her computer's microphone, but rather borrowed a popular song. If any of you are familiar with DDR, I won't make any of you come up here, but this was a particularly hip version of a similar idea. So press space to begin, hit the arrow keys in time with the arrows to score points. Watch out, if your score goes negative, you fail. So this was Ann Chi's implementation, another former student. Okay, I hit the left key, left, 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 right, right. And notice the use of multiple variables at the top. And now it will gradually get a little harder, they're going to come faster. So again, this too, not something she probably bit off all at once, but rather built it up incrementally, made one sprite, and in fact, you'll see that these sprites all look very similarly. Once she got a sprite working nicely, the one that was maybe green and going up the left-hand column, she probably then right-clicked on that sprite, copied it, and tweaked it a little bit. So there too, if there's a lot of redundancy, a lot of parallelism, you can sort of reuse your own code. Let me show you one other so that if you're feeling a bit daunted by perhaps some of the interactivity here, let me show you this one, which is just as compelling, I think, but a little more accessible. And this one is called, I think I am missing it. So let me show, can't contradict myself there. David. Well, perhaps you'd like to play this one, or maybe Dan would sometime. So. This one was actually written by an MIT grad student who introduced me to Scratch. This one has the upside of being able to punch. And you'll notice that thanks to a variable called score that's keeping track of how many times I've been punched, my face is clearly changing colors, different sounds based on which hand is hitting me, and now I've collapsed there. I'll give you one other example. I mean, frankly, this is kind of what happens, at least if you're like me and you kind of get addicted to this stuff and you start poking around at some of the sample projects. This is the one that cost me some 8 hours of my life on a Friday night years ago. So I don't know why, but my vision was I want to implement a program where Oscar the Grouch pops his head out of a trash can while you try to put trash in his trash can. So, not sure what inspired that, but I then made the mistake of choosing a wonderfully annoying song to listen to on loop for 8 hours while writing this. So here's the piece of trash. Notice if mouse pointer touching and I click, it apparently sticks effectively to the trash. If I hover near enough to this, the trash can comes up, and then if I drop it in, he then pops up. And it is ever so wonderfully synchronized with the various pieces of trash that are falling. So, what are some of the building blocks that something a little more like that uses? Well, just to point out a couple of ideas so that you have them in your toolkit, so to speak, there's also this notion in programming and in Scratch specifically of events. So we've seen mechanisms thus far via which two sprites can kind of communicate. You can say if one is touching the other, similar to that brief Oscar time demo there. But you can also have sprites more explicitly talk to one another, at least in a programmatic sense. So this is a program with two sprites, and I've just kind of pasted them into the slide, that allows one sprite to talk to the other. And again, as with Scratch, you can kind of infer from context what this is doing. But the sprite on the left does the following. When the green flag is clicked, forever do the following. Now you tell me, what does this sprite on the left do? Exactly. You press the space key, it says Marco for 2 seconds, and then this new statement. So there's this notion of events, and there's this idea of listening for events in the world of programming. And an event is a means by which one program, essentially, or sprite in this case, can signal another. It's like you don't hear voices coming out of your computer, so to speak, but rather programs can talk to one another by broadcasting an event. And so long as the other program or sprite is listening for that same event, it can then respond to that event by doing something, right? And this is nice because this way, your programs don't need to be governed entirely by user input, right? You don't have to have every sprite run only when the user clicks a green flag. You can have a sprite do something when another sprite tells it to do that something. So in this case, Marco on the left here is not only going to say his name for 2 seconds, he then is going to broadcast something called an event. And then on the right-hand side, such a simple program, this second sprite, the girl, says, when I receive event, because she's listening for this, essentially. What does she do? She says polo. So this was a very simple idea. If you think back to playing this game in a swimming pool, this was a means by which two sprites, each with its own thread, that is, its own script, can intercommunicate. So if I hit play, nothing happens yet until I go ahead and hit the space. Marco says his thing, and now the girl responds with polo. So, questions?
So there's a lot of fun to be had with Scratch, and we've shown you how to use it, and we've introduced a lot of these programming constructs to do it, but how do you actually download Scratch? Well, if you point your web browsers to scratch.mit.edu, they actually make it very, very easy for you to get it from their website. And you'll notice that in addition to downloading Scratch, which you can do from the right side of the page, they also have some projects that appear on the web page. So if you design a project that you are very, very proud of, whether it be a game, an animation, or any one of these other types of interactive or even fun examples that David has shown, you can actually publish it on their website, and you can see what other people have published to see what kind of projects they are working on. And let's see, I actually haven't tried any of these, but I'm sure that you would be able to find some very, very interesting things, just like what David has shown over there. Throughout this hour. So if you download Scratch, it's actually very easy to do. You just download the file, and as soon as you open it, you can begin working on it. As you can see, I've already downloaded the Scratch program, and as soon as I open it, they give you a blank stage, but it also gives you some example projects to get you started. So not only will you have all of these examples that David has shown you under your belt, or at least be a little bit familiar by having seen them, you can take a look at some of the projects that they give you. You can see that when I try to open one, they actually have a number of projects that we can try here. So let's just try chicken noodle soup, I guess. See what this involves. I guess I need my sound plugged in. Which is perhaps just as annoying or even more so than all of the programs and scripts that David has shown.
But I got one more perhaps on which we can end. It's perhaps a little seasonal here. This is a story told by another student of two gingerbread cookies meeting and falling in love.
I can't stay in love and nobody but
watch this, though, this time, think about how you would implement some of these ideas. And you can probably infer some of the underlying programmatic constructs that the student used. Right, so each gingerbread person is waiting some number of seconds before reacting, then they're both moving in lockstep. Three more sprites apparently appear. And there's definitely some trial and error. She probably has to sit there listening to the song, figuring out how many seconds to wait to synchronize this, so it took a bit of effort for that. So on that most heartfelt note, why don't we call it an evening, and we will see you next week for the exam. We'll stick around for any questions.